Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the myth-busting ancient history podcast. Today's intro is coming at you live from a birthing centre in the modern world, which is fitting because today's episode is all about, if you excuse the pregnant pause, pregnancy. Joining us today are the usual team. We have midwife Xenia, ready to slap life into the facts about the ancient Romans. Dr. Meg, here to ensure you're making healthy choices for you and the ancient Greeks. Ward Steward Barney, who's ready and willing to clean up any myths you might have heard about the ancient Near East. And I'm your patient Flo. Patiently waiting, that is, to learn all about the ancient world with you, our listener. Now, before we proceed, I'd like to say that the topics we cover in this mini-series might be considered sensitive. Additionally, this episode will deal with topics such as child loss. If you feel that the subject matter might be upsetting to you, we'd advise catching up with us again in Against the Law Season 6. And as a disclaimer, terminology we use in this series might be based on ancient assumptions about sex and gender, which could not align with modern standards or understanding. And it ought to go without saying, but please, please do not try any of the ancient methods of treating gynecological health, contraception, fertility boosters, pregnancy advice, or childbirth methods that we talk about in these episodes. Not only will they not work, but they could cause you serious harm. And with that out of the way, let's get ready to learn about today's topic. We are now going to be talking about pregnancy. So Xenia and I are now quite familiar with pregnancy, seeing as we're both in our third trimester of our first pregnancies. And there's a lot of commiserations to have between us about various symptoms that we've been having. So let's talk about pregnancy from a sort of a modern viewpoint. We split it into three trimesters, don't we? So we have the first trimester, which is usually where you're throwing up a lot and you're feeling a lot of new sensations. You have the second trimester, which is tends to be a bit better but goes very quickly. And now we're well into our third trimesters, and I'm tired. I just want it to be done with. I just want to buy cute baby grows. That's all I want now. Did the ancients split their pregnancies up into different trimesters?
Not so much, because they weren't very good at counting. Partly. I mean, it's quite difficult to count a pregnancy anyway, to be honest, isn't it? I mean, now we count from the date of your last missed period in terms of trying to calculate the due date. But even that is like really, it's quite dubious as a counting system. And at the end of the day, the baby comes when it wants to come. Like it's a 5-week window, I think, now recommended by the WHO in terms of rather than a specific sort of date, because everyone's a little bit different. So the Romans particularly didn't really bother with counting, and there were so many different theories in the Roman world kind of flying around about how long it took to gestate a human baby. There's one doctor who was like, oh, it could be 8 months or it could be 10 months, but definitely not 9 months, which seems quite funny now. But what Serranus does, he's our big expert on ancient gynecology, or at least our extant expert on ancient gynecology. He does have kind of three different periods that he has advice for in terms of during the pregnancy, but he doesn't really split them into trimesters. It's not like they're kind of equal splits. Instead, he kind of goes by what the important bits are in the pregnancy. So at first, he really has a lot to say about making sure that the fertilized egg implants and kind of stays there. So effectively encouraging conception and encouraging retention. So what he says to do is bed rest for a couple of days, followed by gentle exercise and lots of bland foods. He says you just shouldn't go through any kind of shaking, because he thinks that might prevent the fertilized egg from implanting. So no carriage rides, not even any cold baths, because you might shiver and that might shake the little zygote or whatever out of the womb. In fact, no baths at all. And for at least a week, no alcohol. As we know from our alcohol episode, the Romans were a bit weird about women drinking alcohol anyway. So it was like absolutely no alcohol, and also no sex, because it also might shake you up a little bit too much.
Goodness.
The Greeks are quite similar to the Romans on miscarriage and avoiding it, I think. Miscarriage was seen very much as a fault of the body. So there was like one idea that the uterus and the cervix could be too smooth, which is an odd image, and the fetus would just sort of slide out. So quite a lot of the advice is aimed at avoiding, you know, smooth uterus issues. One other bit of advice is to insert a lead probe. Again, that's the second time lead has come up in this mini series, which is worrying. Insert a lead probe into the vagina, and then, not sure what it's meant to do there, but then lie with your legs crossed for 6 days without washing or eating solid food. So I think that kind of sounds like some of the stuff Zenny has been talking about. So that's the miscarriage advice.
So lead insertion aside, there are a few parallels there. In England, with the NHS, we are advised to avoid alcohol in the first trimester. I will say that during the entire pregnancy, I've had one glass of Prosecco because I, unbeknownst to me, moved house whilst pregnant, had no clue, and I don't normally drink, and I had a glass of Prosecco and I felt guilty ever since. But there are some bits of advice there that maybe we could follow. Gentle exercise. The bath bit, though, that is right out there. I'm not about to give up my bathing.
No, it is quite funny. And he Saranis does acknowledge that there are plenty of women who do all of those things and are still fine. Yeah, like I went for a 10k walk in 30 degrees after when I was unknowingly pregnant in the first week after pregnancy. And I was like, yeah, it's cool. Yeah. Baby's still here.
Women do all sorts while pregnant and are generally pretty resilient. I do wonder as well about some of the advice there. So avoiding alcohol, avoiding bathing, whatever. Did they have any advice for common pregnancy maladies? Like in the first trimester, a really common thing to have is morning sickness, and it's called morning sickness. But I think that probably refers mostly to the morning of a pregnancy. So if you think of the pregnancy as a full day, you've got the morning is the first trimester, the afternoon is the second, and the evening is the third. And typically you only really get morning sickness at the beginning of your pregnancy, but you can, it's a bit of a misnomer because you can get it all day and all night and anytime it will just spring up on you. So did we have any advice from the ancients about pregnancy maladies like morning sickness?
Yeah, Saranis is your guy here again. So even though this kind of first initial sort of post-conception advice is a little bit extreme maybe, from then onwards he's really quite sensible. So this kind of morning sickness stage, the Romans called it pica, which is actually now a term that's used for women who have like really odd cravings. So Saranis was quite aware of that, and what he says to do is actually fast. So don't eat for a day, then have a nice oil massage, and then eat some really nice, like soft, easy to eat foods like eggs or sort of porridgey type things. Just nice, bland, gentle foods that are easy to go down. He says not to indulge cravings.
Very much like the NHS advice, really, isn't it? I'd be interested to know what our listeners' weirdest cravings have been. My first clue that I might be pregnant is because I got a really weird craving for artificial foam banana flavour. So like the artificial banana flavour you get from banana milkshakes or foam bananas, just couldn't get enough of it. Don't know why.
That is a sick flavour, to be honest. I love it.
Yeah, it was a good one. That over chalk or cheese or whatever. Yep, I was quite chuffed with that. Zenya, did you have any weird cravings?
Mine have mostly been for sweet things, to be honest. quite early on, I had a massive craving for chocolate mousse.
Nice.
Yeah, and then last night, Maltesers.
Lately, it's been fish and radishes, not together, I will hasten to add, and yogurt. I don't know why. Yogurt and milk.
I think I found when I was reading up on this stuff that in the ancient Near East, in certain Near Eastern traditions like Judaism, there's this division between the first 40 days of pregnancy and then those thereafter. And I think it's from like rabbinic literature. Often they considered that the first 40 days the woman was sort of barely pregnant, and so at that time the baby is sort of not a baby, just a sort of fluid, and that after that, that's when true pregnancy begins. I don't know if there's anything like that in Greece and Rome, but I thought that was an interesting division. It sounds to me like that sort of nice round literary number of 40 days, like in the story of Noah or something like that. I don't know how they settled on it.
It's weirdly quite similar to that in my experience of healthcare in the UK, where when I found out that I was pregnant, I went to the GP and said, hello, I'm pregnant. And the response was very much, okay, I'm going to set you up with some appointments and we'll see you in a couple of months, or we'll see you way down the line. And it was very odd because I expected it to be all action stations. But I think there's quite a reserved opinion because baby loss is very common early on in pregnancy. So there's a sort of resistance to go, right, okay, we've got a secured baby in the womb. And there was just this really long wait to find out if things were normal and developing normally. So it was like this weird Schrodinger's baby where I knew that I was pregnant, but nobody even had done a scan or a check or anything like that. So that weird like fluidity of could be.
I love Schrodinger's baby. And actually I think that kind of binary that does seem to match, as you say, the way that this line of thought goes about it. Because apparently there's a story about Cleopatra that on the 41st day of her pregnancy, the baby was fully formed as a sort of embryo.
How did she know?
I'm indebted to a scholar called Martin Stoll for this, because he's made an interesting connection here. That because Alexandria was a centre of medicine and medical research in the ancient world, especially in the Ptolemaic period, the Greco-Roman period of Egyptian history, they may have examined bodies with dissection. And so that was one suggestion from the scholars to how they might have come to draw these conclusions about Cleopatra's pregnancy was through dissection, but obviously she wasn't dissected.
I mean, so what's 40 days in weeks? That's nearly six weeks, right?
Yeah.
That's very early on. So I had a scan at, I think, 8 weeks because I had a bleed, which is quite common quite early in pregnancy, and they just wanted to check that everything was all right. And for me, eight weeks was very much a blob. There wasn't a particularly defined baby that was there. So I wonder if, Xenia, your earlier scan, did it look like a baby? Because mine definitely didn't.
My eight-week scan was just a blob with a heartbeat. It only starts to look like a baby, really, at like 12 weeks.
But that 40 days is weirdly accurate because at 6 weeks, I think that was when I first knew, firstly, that I was pregnant, because it's quite common that you find out at 5-6 weeks. And then also had interacted with healthcare professionals at that point.
So in terms of what the ancient Greeks thought about pregnancy, they very much did describe a sort of process for what happens inside the womb. They thought that the fetus would first become foam, then blood, and then flesh. So again, a bit of an unnerving image. And then take form. And it's sort of slightly unclear what take form means, but this does seem to be a description of, you know, the fetus becoming a baby, or, you know, looking like a baby, taking shape. But they also thought that this process happened very different for male fetuses and female fetuses, which is interesting and also really annoying. The Hippocratic writers in the 5th century BC thought that boys took form quicker than girls. They thought that boys took 30 days to take form inside the womb, and girls take 48, a whopping 48 days. And, you know, that's apparently because male fetuses are stronger, but they also originate from a stronger and thicker seed. So I'll leave you with that. But yeah, very frustrating.
I guess like with many things in the ancient world, we can probably acknowledge that, you know, this was fairly well observed over many thousands of years, and that, yeah, settling on around that sort of 6 week period was how they arrived at 40 days might be one way of explaining it, since you guys both have evidence to agree with that. Interestingly, there is a Akkadian word for embryo, and they did have a conception of fetuses. The Akkadian word's quite cool. It's two words. It's Sha Libisha. And Sha Libisha means that of her belly, the one of her belly.
Really sweet.
And there are these really strange little statues that, little terracotta statuettes, I should say, that look like tiny little emaciated men with ribs, and they're sort of curled over with their head towards their core, a bit like a baby in the womb. And so there's a theory that those represent fetuses, and they had a sort of a religious position. Actually kind of reminds me of Dante's Inferno. There was like a position of embryos, the unborn child sort of lived in the underworld in the Mesopotamian understanding. And so when Gilgamesh goes down to the underworld in one of the Sumerian versions, he sees these unborn fetuses, these small emaciated things.
Ooh, that's terrifying.
It's quite creepy. And they're not necessarily malignant or malign, but they do have a slight potential to like cause ill.
So early on in the pregnancy, I think I mentioned previously that I had a little bleed, which can be really common, but it can be a symptom of something a bit more serious. Now, I presume that in the ancient world, miscarriage and stillbirth was far more common than we experience today. It is a very common thing that we don't actually talk about that much openly in the modern world either. But I presume through various different health issues and also lack of maybe medical knowledge that it was more common in the ancient world. Do we have any stories from the ancient world about specifically miscarriage or stillbirth?
So yeah, I do have a story from Roman times. I've got the story of Pliny the Younger's wife's baby loss. So last time we had Pliny the Elder's horrible contraceptive methods, and now we have Pliny the Younger, who's Pliny the Elder's nephew. So he was married three times, but didn't have any children by his first two wives. And then when he was about 40, he married a 14-year-old called Calpurnia. And he's quite good friends with her grandfather. And he writes him a lot of letters. So Pliny the Younger is quite famous for writing loads and loads of letters to fairly important people in like during his historical period. So his letters are quite valuable. However, the reason I don't like him is because he writes in a really self-important way, and he's writing these letters with a view to publishing them afterwards. And you can kind of tell from the way he's writing it, he always wants to make himself look like some sort of, you know, really self-important, like avuncular figure giving advice, dispensing advice to all of these high up senators, or, you know, showing off just how chummy he is with the Emperor Trajan. And I just find it utterly sickening. Anyway, this letter to his wife's grandfather is sad, but is also slightly sickening. He informs his wife's grandfather that his wife has had a miscarriage. And basically he says that she, because she was so young, she wasn't aware that she was pregnant and didn't take necessary precautions. So throwing back to what Sarana says about the immediate aftermath of conception, what you should do, presumably she went in a bumpy carriage ride, or, you know, lifted some heavy things. He doesn't actually specify what she did or didn't do. And he does imply that this was actually life-threatening for her as well. So we just don't know how late her miscarriage was. So the way he phrases it is really galling, actually. He says, "You will be very grieved in your old age to hear that you have been cheated of a great grandchild which was on its way to you. And yet, please be thankful to the gods that although they've refused you the great-grandchild, they have preserved your granddaughter's life."
That's awful. So this poor pregnant teenage girl,
yeah,
who is only 2 years into teenagerhood,
yeah,
is being blamed by her minging husband,
yeah,
for losing a baby and a threat to her own life as well.
Yeah.
That's an attitude that unfortunately is still kind of prevalent. There's a lot of guilt and a lot of blame that is put on mothers even now, especially young mothers. That is still quite prevalent. But it's sad that this poor young girl is in this situation, and her poor body has only probably just gone through puberty as well. Mm-hmm. So she's learning new things about her body all the time. What an awful, awful human being.
It does feel very victim blamey, that, doesn't it?
It does.
I think one thing that we've realised in doing this mini-series is that, you know, women's health and how women are treated in the medical sense is a pretty good litmus test for how women are more broadly treated by whichever society or culture that we're talking about. And I thought you might be interested to hear by comparison. And actually, I think this is something we've talked about before when talking about women's bodies in the ancient Near East, that abortion was something that is acknowledged in Mesopotamia, but only one period of history is it sort of illegal in a sense. There are laws actually provisioning against it, which nobody will be surprised to hear is the Middle Assyrian period, that really horrible period where women are punished for so many things. And if a woman in Assyria at this time attempted to abort her baby, the punishment is impaling.
Good God. Wow.
Yeah, it's really, really despicable. And I think we talked about that before. But yeah, one of the theories about that is that, you know, it's sort of protecting the family, basically, and the right for the man to have his baby, and that the woman has really no say over whether she wants to keep it or not. And yeah, so that's another way that we can see how poorly women were regarded in this particular period in history.
So I think it's especially relevant at the moment, because this year in the US, talking about women's bodily autonomy, we've experienced the repeal of Roe v. Wade, which is a whole topic in and of itself. But it gives different states the ability to remove bodily autonomy for women when it comes to pregnancies. And I think it's really important to say that abortions are regularly performed for the sake of the parent's health as well. So in the case of ectopic pregnancy, or where a body might struggle to carry a baby to term, but also for things like mental health and financial health. There are a myriad of reasons why a woman might wish to terminate a pregnancy. And I think it's quite shocking that things haven't really, unlikely to be impaled in the US anytime soon for arranging an abortion for yourself. But it's not, you know, there are significant penalties for the not only the mother involved, but also any healthcare professionals who would go against state legislature when it comes to performing and carrying out abortions. Because presumably there are methods throughout history to induce miscarriage or abortion at home.
Yeah, abortions were fairly common in the Roman world as well, even though they were also, like in the ancient Near East, illegal, because they were also viewed as like the father's property. So if you got rid of a baby, that was effectively destruction of property. It was a crime. However, we have loads of evidence, particularly in kind of the Roman upper classes, that it was fairly common. So, for example, Ovid writes in his Amores, he writes two poems about his girlfriend Corinna having an abortion. And they're really quite moving to read, because he goes through so many different emotions. Again, you know, this abortion was could have been life-threatening to Corinna. So his first poem is he's freaking out, basically, that she might die from having had an abortion. And she didn't tell him either that she was going to have one. So, you know, she's gone off, she's done this, and now she's incredibly unwell. And he's absolutely terrified that he's going to lose her. And then in the second one, his fear turns to anger. And he says all sorts of, to be honest, quite unkind things about, you know, women who've had abortions. But you can tell that that's just part of like him expressing his fear through anger, because right at the end of the poem, after having said some quite upsetting things, he says, actually, you know what, just please gods, let her live and I will forgive her this crime.
And if I throw over to Meg, what was the attitude in ancient Greece when it comes to abortion?
So the Greeks have a really interesting attitude to abortion. It doesn't seem to be a crime in general, but it does release miasma or pollution, which is something the Greeks were very scared of, and it needs to be sort of purified. And this is where it gets really interesting. So they said there's inscriptions from temples that basically say, if you've just had an abortion, you can't come into the temple because you're unclean and you need to be purified. But if it's an early stage abortion, and what they describe this as is before the fetus takes shape. So again, this idea of sort of a fetus forming in the womb, taking shape. If you have it at that early stage, then you have to wait 7 days before going into the temple. But that is the same amount of time as you have to wait just after giving birth. They also thought childbirth released pollution. So an early stage abortion and just a normal childbirth is exactly the same to the Greeks in terms of the pollution being released. That's according to one temple inscription. Whereas if you have a late stage, what we might call a late stage abortion, after the fetus has, to use their phrase or translation, taken shape, then it releases a lot more pollution. And in their terms, that would be a lot more similar to the amount of miasma or pollution that would be released for a crime like theft or murder. So I think that is super interesting. There's very much a discussion being had about when, I guess in our terms, again, when life is formed or something like that. Aristotle talks about the sort of life or sense appearing at a certain point in a fetus in the womb. So yeah, really, really interesting stuff. They were definitely thinking about it in medical, legal and religious terms.
So when you're talking about abortion in the world of the ancient Greeks, is that legal to perform or have?
In terms of the legality of it specifically, there's one fragment that we have from a writer who suggests that an abortion could be a crime against the father of the fetus, because technically at some point that could have been a child that would have inherited his estate. So that's one approach to it, but we don't have a huge amount of evidence for that. They much more do seem to be talking about it in terms of the sort of religious aspect, like the miasma that I was just talking about, or in terms of the medical approach. There's a really interesting thing that the Hippocratic corpus, spoken about quite a lot, sort of 5th-4th century important medical texts, says that you shall not put a pessary inside a woman to induce an abortion. But it's very clear on that. No pessaries. And this is a subject of quite a lot of debate. But basically, some people think that pessary were meant to take that as meaning no abortions. Abortions are bad, don't do them. But some people say, no. The fact that it really specifies don't use a pessary very much implies that other methods of inducing an abortion are okay. So that's a subject of debate in the ancient world and in the modern world in terms of how we interpret that statement. So again, very much a discussion being had and sometimes contradictory viewpoints. But that is, you know, you can expect that from the age of the evidence and the amount of different sources we have.
So that's really interesting. And again, there I can see loads of parallels almost with the modern world. So we have talked a lot about abortion now, but I'm wondering if there is any methodologies whereby you might want to keep a pregnancy or keep it safe.
So obviously pregnancy is a pretty turbulent time for mothers and risky throughout, all the way up to, you know, the moment of birth. But luckily, our old friend apotropaism, provides a lot of ways to protect mothers and their unborn babies in the ancient Near East. So there are lots of amulets that you find and particular demons who are associated with protecting the mother. So the protective demon of mothers is called Pazuzu. And Pazuzu is sort of one of those beastly demons with like a lion's head and claws and big talons and stuff, the idea being that it would scare away evil. So it's quite a monstrous looking demon, Pazuzu, but it was actually in place to protect mothers. And Pazuzu has an enemy who actually looks a bit similar, called Lamashtu, who's the bad one, who's the one who's trying to attack the mother and take away the fetuses and stuff like that. And one of the main depictions of these two are on these plaques, these kind of apotropaic plaques, basically, in which the demon Lamashtu is depicted and Pazuzu's holding the entire plaque. So it's her claws are sort of like sticking over the top of it and face at the top. And then you can see Lamashtu sort of in her grasp. What's interesting, though, is that Pazuzu is, in fact, the name of the demon in The Exorcist.
I was going to say, isn't that Father Merrin's like enemy?
Exactly. Yeah, they picked the wrong one, basically. Pazuzu is actually the good one. So if the possessing demon in The Exorcist had been Lamashtu, that would have been closer to the ancient Near Eastern reality, but instead they went with Pazuzu. It's a pretty good name, I guess.
Yeah, it's a great name, and also it's got this sort of ancient Near East, slightly sort of interesting and exotic enough to be the unknown vibe.
Yeah, dare I say, orientalized, actually.
Yes.
That the big enemy of the Christian exorcist is this sort of oriental mystical demon, evil and eastern. So that's demons. There was also a protective god in ancient Egypt called Ta-Weret.
Was she a hippo?
That's right.
Why do I know that?
It's just it's innate pregnancy knowledge. You just learn these things.
maybe she's been following me. I've had a tricky time with preeclampsia, so maybe I've got this hippo goddess just looking after me.
So Ta-Weret actually recently appeared in the Marvel TV series Moon Knight. I don't know if anybody watched that. It's got a very loose reception of certain aspects of Egyptian mythology in it. And Ta-Weret appears as you know, a big hippo god inside the hospital where the main character and his second self kind of find themselves, and she's supposed to be guiding them to some sort of afterlife. But in reality, she was a domestic goddess, so didn't have any cult temples, but was sort of worshipped in the home, and she protected mothers with her fierce hippo head and crocodile tail down her back. And she's got a big bulging belly and sort of hanging breasts, so she has that sort of fertility associations. And yeah, she would ward off evil in the same way that Pazuzu would, to protect mothers.
I really love this kind of powerful protective element that's then coupled with big boobs and the big belly and the kind of feminine aspects of pregnancy, or the, yeah, that these kind of recognizable bodily aspects of femininity. Because it just, I just, sometimes the ancient world is just really good at sort of getting women a bit more right, if that makes sense, than the kind of demure, quiet, passive stereotype that's evolved since. I don't know, I feel like with every goddess that you bring out, Barney, I feel so much more self-recognition than I do with any kind of Romans.
I mean, without making too many generalizations, and obviously the position of women has changed a lot since the ancient world, but Egypt is generally quite even-handed towards both men and women. And yeah, I completely agree with you, Xenia. It's wonderful that you have this fearsome female goddess who protects and is, you know, beautiful and fertile at the same time. Her name means the great one as well. So she is a great one.
She is. I love that. That's really sweet.
I've got a good pregnancy story from ancient Egypt as well, actually.
Oh, go.
And this was something that I had the pleasure of seeing in person when I was in Egypt recently. At the mortuary temple of Egyptian pharaoh Hatshepsut, so one of the few and great Egyptian female pharaohs. We've talked about her before because she depicted herself as a male ruler, despite being a woman. So she represented herself with the false beard of the god Osiris, for example. So at her mortuary temple, which is where her sort of death cult would be worshipped after she died, but it was built during her life, there's a brilliant relief on the walls and an inscription that tells the story of her conception. And her mother is depicted on the wall with a pregnant belly. So you can see, you know, very traditional Egyptian style of art. And just this beautiful sort of bulge of Hatshepsut's mother pregnant with her. But the reason why that's there and the important thing about it is that she is claiming that her father was the great god Amun. And it was Amun who impregnated her mother. And so, you know, that's an attempt at sort of justifying her rule and inserting herself into that sort of kingship ideology of being divinely ordained and, in this case, conceived. The key image of it is just that, her pregnant mother, and I think it's a really cool thing to see on the wall of an Egyptian temple.
That's really cool. That must be so cool to have seen with your own eyes as well. Right, I'm now staring right at the sort of the finish line. I'm getting closer and closer to popping and giving birth. Have we got any advice for people in their third trimester, or any information about the third trimester, or what we call the third trimester, the last little bit of pregnancy before we give birth?
Yep, I do have some Roman advice here. So, Soranus is really quiet from the morning sickness stage right up until the seventh month. And then at that point, he says, you should have ramped up the exercise throughout, and then you should start slowing down your exercise, which I can very much sympathise with at the moment. Like, I've been on a good exercise routine throughout pregnancy, but now I'm really feeling very heavy and exercise is much, much harder now. And he also says, and this is something that, again, I really love on a personal level, using linen support bandages to support the bump and relieve a bit of the weight. And because I'm carrying all at the front, oh my gosh, my belly band, I have to wear it every single day. Otherwise, I just feel awful. So I really love Soranus's advice on that.
That's so funny, because all women have all sorts of different pains and we carry babies in different ways, but there's quite a common thing called PGP, which is pelvic girdle pain, otherwise known as symphysis pubis disorder or something like that. And one of the recommendations is that you wear a belly band. So I really like that actually we've always had to go, oh God, we need a bit of extra support going on here. Can we get a sling for our big bellies, please?
Yep.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot.
All right, so before we wrap up then, I just wanted to share a little proverb And actually thinking about that Hatshepsut story of divine conception, not necessarily immaculate, but certainly divine, made me remember that over in Mesopotamia, they wouldn't have taken any bullshit about people being mysteriously pregnant. So this great proverb says, has she become pregnant without intercourse? Well, has she become fat without eating?
I find it really funny that that's a thing. Like, well, it takes two to tango, you know. So, you know, obviously something's happened there. So maybe on those Great Walls, a moon being the daddy, maybe not quite meshing with that proverb.
Yeah, yeah. The Sumerians would be having none of it.
Like, well, someone's done something here. Okay, fab. Well, let's move on to our favourite things then, I think. Barney, I'm going to start with you because that proverb was ace. What's your favourite thing that you've learnt today?
Well, I quite like hearing that while some of Soranus's advice is obviously leave something to be desired or is perhaps a little ill-informed, given the sort of medical understanding of the time, that there are still little parts of it, like the bandages that you just mentioned, that you know, are still useful and still kind of comforting to mothers today. So, yeah, whilst we obviously wouldn't recommend that people follow all of Soranus's advice, it's really quite nice to hear, especially from two pregnant people, that there are bits of it that, you know, still kind of ring true. And I really like that sort of personal touch to these bits of history.
Definitely. In which case, I'm going to hop over to our resident Soranus expert, Xenia. What's your favourite thing that you've learned today?
I think my favourite thing was, is it Tarweret, the hippo goddess?
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like her sort of protective feminine power.
Definitely. I think that was one of my favourites as well. And then on the flip side, I'm going to go to the person who's told us about more suspicious stuff to put up a vagina to avoid miscarriage. Meg, what was your favourite thing to learn today?
Well, I'm going to be greedy and kind of have two favourite things, because I thought Xenia's stories about Ovid and Pliny were so interesting, their attitudes to their wives and girlfriends and their sort of pregnancies and abortions and baby loss and all that. But it wasn't really my favourite thing because I think their attitudes were bad and annoying as well. So interesting, but not likeable. What I really liked and also thought was interesting was also Barney's story about the mortuary temple and the sort of relief and inscription with the story of Hatshepsut's conception. Hatshepsut's conception is a bit of a tongue twister. But yeah, I really loved that. Thought that was great.
Yeah, that was interesting. I found that interesting as well. I've got to say, I really like Barney's proverb. It sounds like something that someone in my northern family would say, Barney. That, well, she didn't get fat by not eating. She didn't get pregnant by not, well, you know.
Yeah, it's quite sarcastic, isn't it?
It is. It's really sassy. I just think it's really funny. So that's my favourite thing that I've learned today. So it has been quite a heavy episode today, I think we can all agree. But let's look forward with our hearts and minds to next episode, where we'll be talking about childbirth.